we're building great tech, we're signing up great customers, like we're getting all this attention and press. And the reason is because we have amazing people in this company and we brought in lots of great people. And so if we're going to continue that, we have to continue to raise the bar on how we hire.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, we're joined by Steve Caldwell. Steve is the VP of Data, Infrastructure, and Security at Springbuck, where he leads a fast-growing team that doubled in 2018. In our conversation, Steve opens up about the lessons he's learned the hard way about burnout and letting go of the keyboard as a leader. We also talked about preparing for the hiring rush that comes with a fundraising announcement. I loved hearing Steve's perspective of scaling a fast growth team, and I'm always looking for more interesting perspectives on fast growth SaaS. If you know any engineering leaders with a different perspective on growth whose voices should be heard, tweet at me, at Wes Winham. I'd love to talk to them. And now, here's my conversation with Steve Caldwell. Steve Caldwell, thanks so much for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Thanks, Wes.
So, Steve, it's good to have you. So, what's a career inflection point for you that's kind of led to where you are today?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that when I think about my career, I sort of divide it into two camps. So, I've been doing software now for about 10 years. Got my start doing IT help desk work at the Army Corps of Engineers as a contractor, and kind of was always interested in building websites and was doing that as a kid, and was always kind of the kid on the block fixing stuff for people. So I didn't go to school for it, but I just had an interest and a knack in it. And since I wasn't a great student in college and took some time off from that, during that hiatus, I ended up getting a job there and then really not going back to school full time. I did end up finishing, but was in the Army Corps of Engineers, went from help desk to a web app development job, building internal tools for a couple of teams there, and then kind of bounced around in different organizations for about 4 years. But I also had a startup on the side. It was essentially a custom app, custom website development shop. And that basically outgrew the day job. And I was working 80 hours a week. And I was fortunate to have an opportunity in the side business come my way that it gave me a tough decision. You know, had two kids at the time, two babies, and got three now. But, you know, it was like that entrepreneurial spirit just was there, and made the decision to leave my day job and to go take the business full time in 2012. So that was kind of the first inflection point. And through that business over the next couple of years, we ramped it up and got to seven figures like in the first year, which was amazing. And you know, it was a lot of fun, but I've learned this about myself over the years. You know, I'm very much a quick start. I like to chase kind of the next big thing, and when I get really excited about something, I go all in. And you know, I just sort of felt like being in an agency wasn't the right thing for me. They're great businesses, but I, you know, just working on projects for other people wasn't as satisfying as the idea of going and building something myself. So at the end of 2013, I got a Pebble smartwatch for Christmas and just became, you remember those things?
Oh yeah, I had one.
Yeah, this is the OG black rubber strap, square. You still had to write everything in C, but they had an SDK and you could bridge that C code out to JavaScript and then you could do things, you know, connect to the web and then pull down things from APIs. So that was fascinating to me. Like the internet on your wrist was just this thing that really blew my mind. And I started thinking about building things, and I put out a couple of just open source projects on the Pebble app store back in the day and got a bunch of devs on there and got really excited about that, but I couldn't see who was using those apps. And this light bulb kind of went off about wearables and people using wearables and creating all this data on their wearables, but no analytic solutions were really geared towards that.
So this is user analytics for Pebble and smart device apps.
Smart device apps was the original idea. So this is, you have to remember, this is 2014. This is before Android Wear. This is before Apple Watch. There was, you know, we had the Samsung Gear, was kind of the flagship smartwatch. and Pebble, and then a handful of other kind of devices. So fast forward 6 months later, we are moving to Cincinnati, Ohio to do the Brandery Accelerator for a wearable analytics platform called Strap. And then 3 months later, we raised $1.5 million to go take that and go run with it, seed round. And so that was, when I think about getting into true SaaS, product-driven SaaS companies, that was the real inflection point for me, and learned a lot through that process.
So you took the jump from IT help desk development, from development to your own full-time consulting business, and then to a SaaS startup on a brand new technology.
Yes.
That fast start. That sounds right.
Yeah, exactly.
And when did you start leading teams? Was it at the Strap, your new company?
No, so it was CrossTech, which was the previous business, the agency. I guess when I was probably the last couple years of my time at DoD, I was sort of like a co-lead on a 5-person developer team. So I had the opportunity to learn about Scrum in 2009 or 2010, and so I implemented it on a team. And then when I went to the next team, I implemented it there. And so I did, early on those first couple of years, really started to understand agile methodologies and the best ways to do ceremonies and the best ways to really everybody rally together to push that boulder up the hill. And so I think that served me well. I wasn't prepared for at all was how to hire, how to fire, having to go through those things the first time is really difficult, and definitely made a lot of mistakes there early on. But
do you remember some of those early mistakes?
Yeah, so actually when I was like the co-lead at still working inside of the DoD, I had an opportunity to make my first hire. And so I put a job rec out there, got a bunch of resumes, and took the highest GPA, weeded out everybody who looked bad on paper, and I hired someone who, was a double major 4.0. Just coming out of school, super sharp, like interviewed really well, and got inside of that environment. And I wasn't equipped to be a manager at that point, right? I kind of was thrown into the fire, but I was also saying like, please throw me into the fire. I'm ready. I want to go hire people, right? So I got what I asked for. And I think like 6 weeks later, I had to ask my government sponsor supervisor to actually let go of that person because it was such a bad experience. So, and that was mortifying because I wasn't a hire fire situation, but I made the decision to bring that person in. And that was the first time that I realized just looking at resume and interview is a really bad idea.
What do you think led you astray in that process?
It was perceived technical aptitude, perceived communication style versus reality, and not really being able to measure that. That was the biggest thing for me. It's like, this person seems to check all the boxes. We had a good conversation. Let's get them in there, give them a try. And ultimately the other piece is just, we didn't find out until it was too late.
Yeah. I hear I grew up as a manager reading like the Joel Spolsky Smart and Get Things Done. And it made me feel like the smart is something I could just feel. And I kind of learned that same lesson, that I could feel smart, and maybe that the smart exists, the smart and able to do this specific work on my team is kind of different things.
Yeah. And I mean, I still fall into the trap sometimes of thinking my gut knows best when it comes to someone's ability to come in here and, really not at Spring, but I think just in general, sounds like you're the same way. But like, ultimately, at the end of the day, we can't just trust our gut and instinct for 100% or more than 10% even. I think it's an important part of it, and it's, you should listen to it, but it's by no means the primary driver in making that decision.
So you founded two companies. That's a lonely experience, or it can be a lonely experience. How have you managed your personal mental health as you've made some of those transitions and kind of been through the trough of despair here and there?
It's definitely been interesting. It's been a process. You know, I've learned a lot about myself, and having built the dev shop and just having, you know, from, I mean, this is 6 years ago, so I was 26. You know, I had a side hustle that was going really well. I felt really positive. Took that into a full-time thing. That thing just went bonkers really quickly. And so the next logical step was my SaaS idea is going to be a $1 billion company, right? And so I was able to sell the consultancy, which was amazing. And so I, you know, felt like everything was just kind of just going up and to the right. And I've learned that's a really dangerous place to be. It's a good place to be, but the late 20s version of me didn't really know anything else in my career because it had always just gone so well. And it's not that I felt like cocky about it. It was just that I was so optimistic, the blind optimism without having the scars of going through failure led me to basically jump to the next decision. And, you know, I mean, big risk, big reward, right? And of course, like hindsight. But, you know, through that 3-year process, I really just burned myself out. You know, doing the accelerator program was great. I met a lot of great people. Network grew tremendously, but the pressure of raising that kind of money, you know, in the full spectrum of startups, $1 million is not that much money, but for, you know, a 6-month idea with a really strong team and confident investors, when you accept that money, the stakes get so much higher and the pressure, you know, the internal pressure got a lot higher. And so just working 16-hour days for years, you know, multiple years, and having a third kid in that process, and building lots of great tech, and not wavering in my excitement and optimism for what the business, what we were trying to do, which is really important, but also not taking care of myself in terms of like just prioritization and setting aside time for my family and for my health. And yeah, so, you know, ultimately we got to the end of 2016 and we were out of money, and I was, you know, just basically professionally, personally sort of at a low point and had to take a step back and really just ask myself, what am I trying to do? You know, what are my goals? I think a part of me was like, a goal is to have a brilliant idea and to be a startup CEO and to go raise a bunch of money and then get acquired. And, you know, that is the wrong lens to view business through. So
what's the better lens that you found?
The thing that just like something that truly lights you on fire that you want to do every day, that even if, you know, money was like no object, you would still want to do it every day, and not about just trying to build something flashy and trying to go make a bunch of money. You know, I'm sure a lot of listeners are like, oh, this is obvious. Like this, but you know, at the time when I was in it, I didn't know. It was brand new to this whole thing. And from the outside looking in, you see the accelerator programs, you see Y Combinator, and you see, you know, companies like Dropbox.
Fundraising announcements, acquisition announcements, big dollar signs. We did our press release for our fundraising today, and it's been, you know, it's all those dopamine hits and all the, you know, people congratulating you, even though this is really like, it's good to celebrate milestones, and it's hard, so we should celebrate it, but it's also in the back of my mind, you know, this is not winning. This is the thing that creates the pressure and allows us to potentially serve our customers, but it's not success, but it's the thing that, you know, gets all the retweets and all the likes.
Yep. And those things feel
it's
good.
An easy trap.
And social media, you know, just as a double-edged sword, like it's created, you know, those dopamine hits through how they design them, and then your entire life and everything you do and every success is put out there. Usually failures aren't, although the good entrepreneurs who fail write postmortems and are very public about it. I did not do that, but it's in my head. At some point I'll get it down on paper. So yeah.
What's your quick postmortem? What's the thing that's in your head? The thing that you learned from 2 years of 16-hour days? And
yeah, it's a lot of what I just said. In addition though, when you have investors, they they aren't the ones operating the business, right? Like, they're there to support you financially. They want to get a return on that investment one day, and they're there to make connections and open doors and help guide the strategy. But at the end of the day, make sure that those folks aren't just going to agree with everything that you say, because even though I thought like everything that I'm saying and the strategy that I'm laying out for how we go sell a wearables data analytics platform to a market that really didn't have the problem, but I convinced myself that the problem was there or that it was coming, and I was really good at convincing them of that as well. And so I don't think I got enough pushback, and I think that's on me, because I really, I was really good at sort of laying out a plan, getting buy-in from a few folks, and then getting my teams to go execute it. And again, that's great if you want to go build software. Like, our teams were, we have some of the best engineers in Cincinnati. Immediately after things kind of wound down, all the developers had jobs, like, instantly. And so we cranked out some great, beautiful products. And so what I've learned there is, like, that's a strength of mine, is at this point in my career, is bringing together people, bringing teams together, getting everyone excited and ignited about what we're going to build, and then seeing that through and seeing that through to the end, is a really good feeling. I don't have to be the CEO of the company. I don't have to be the front man. I don't have to be the guy with all the ideas about the market and how to do sales, because frankly, I'm not that good at those things. And so that's the biggest thing I learned through that experience. And I think by just finally coming to terms with that here at Springbuck, it's served me well. I feel like, really hitting my stride at this point.
Yeah. I think that reality distortion field that you had to convince investors, it's a powerful, powerful force for good. And it can be a force for not so good. I think you can convince yourself. You can believe your own distortion field.
Right. Yeah. I think that's where, like, being your own worst enemy comes in.
So thinking about the second time around, you've learned about kind of mental health and burning the candle at both ends. What are some things that you've changed for your time at Springbuck?
Yeah, so this is top of mind right now, because it is the new year, and this time of year, people are making resolutions and setting goals for the year. And this is really the first time in the last couple of years that I have felt like I have a clear vision for 2019, and that I have goals that are achievable that I can execute on every day. And the reason I'm so confident about being able to hit those goals is because I'm really thinking about it. It's basically time management, but it's the way that I'm envisioning it in my mind every day, is sort of like, what are you doing today to reach this goal, right? So I want to save X dollars in cash this year. What decision am I making today, or what am I doing in my budget today that's going to support that goal? I want to hit the following three rocks at work this year. I want to get these three major initiatives done. I have a due date of June 1st. Am I going to procrastinate like I have done at times in the past? And that never leads to burnout, right? Or am I going to actually start pacing myself? So these are, I think the kids would just call it adulting. That's how I feel sometimes. I'm just like, at the end of the day, when I internalize them, I'm like, yeah, this is stuff I've heard before, but it can be very hard when you're like, I think both of us are, just hard charging, entrepreneurial spirit, want to kind of solve all the world's problems. It can be hard to just shut down the engines and recharge the batteries and say, look, I'm going to get this thing done in this next time period, and then I'm going to stop. I'm not going to go into just an endless loop of working on it for the next 6 hours, because after this amount of time, my brain is not going to function, and I just need to go to sleep or read a book or exercise. All those things combined have really started to make a difference.
So it sounds like this year you got a plan that allows you to pace yourself a little bit better. Is that kind of
Exactly. And it's a plan that has sort of informing, or at least my capacity to develop the plan and to execute the plan has been forming over the last several years, through wins, through losses, kind of just always taking time to self-reflect and learning, like, that I don't have to, you know, I don't have to make everybody happy. I don't have to beat myself up about everything that I screw up. Like, just like focus on the plan, keep executing it, keep driving towards it. So all of those thoughts have sort of just been up there along the way. And I think recently, in the last couple of months, just like the light turned on that ultimately it's confidence in being able to execute on the plan, which I think I've lacked in the past, lacked confidence internally, even though I've exuded it. Folks will tell me you seem very confident, but internally sort of like the imposter syndrome. And I think it's important for really young entrepreneurs, especially who are walking into some very intimidating situations, to figure out as soon as possible how to wake up every morning and, you know, look at yourself in the mirror, give yourself a pep talk, and, you know, really, really trust yourself and go get it. Go get what you want.
It's an interesting, I hadn't thought about it like that. So the confidence to pace yourself, to know you're going to hit your goals, can help you avoid the burnout that causes you to sometimes miss your goals, that extra 6 hours that introduces more bugs than it causes.
Exactly. Yep. And that's through actually pacing yourself and seeing the benefits of it in small doses. And, you know, over time you start to, I think, build that muscle memory. And I think that's where ultimately the confidence comes in. It's like sports, like anything you practice, right? Golf is a huge confidence game. And, you know, it takes years to be out there and understand how the game works and how your swing works. But then even beyond that, you've got to play a lot to go out and really feel like, yeah, I can hit this shot. You know, I know if I pull this wedge out and I take it back 3/4, I'm going to hit it 63 yards, right? Like that, being able to do that takes years and years and years of mental and physical training. And the same principles apply. I mean, as human beings, the same principles apply to anything that we do, relationships, business, anything.
So you've founded a couple tech companies, worn different hats, seen some scaling. So what's the biggest scaling challenge that you've encountered?
At the beginning of last year, Springbuck raised the $20 million Series B. And at the time, I was our VP of technology. So essentially VP of engineering and infrastructure and security. And we had been developing a budget for 2018 based on sort of the fundraising process and how it was going. But we knew as a 40-ish person company with $20 million coming in the bank, and we had plans for how we were going to spend it, we were about to ramp up. And we had a ton of, you know, job postings out there for different types of engineers. And we did the Series B announcement. And I think within the first couple of weeks, we had like 1,000 applications. It was quite overwhelming. And we had no internal HR at all. So we had no talent manager, no recruiting help. You know, I used outside recruiters from time to time for the really high priority positions that we needed to fill. But it was me doing phone screens all throughout the week. I mean, I would do 4 or 5 phone screens a day, and these are 30-minute calls, some of them. So we're talking hours and hours of time spent a week just trying to figure out who to bring in to interview. And luckily, a handful of positions we were able to fill through our network, a lot of word-of-mouth referrals. We had worked with certain engineers who are well-respected locally and who had done great work for us. And so when they say, hey, you need to go talk to this person, that's just the kind of...
Strong signal.
The strong signal, yeah. And it's much better than my gut, right? The gut is still part of it, of course, but validation is the most important thing now when looking. So anyway, we as a company, we added, I believe, 48 people in 2018, and
so went from 40 to like almost 90, yeah, so more than double.
Yeah, at So we actually, we're about 100 people now, but we've added, I think we added like 7 the first couple weeks of this year. So anyway, that was, I mean, just last year was a blur, and, but it was a blur in a good way. Like looking back and going, you know, doubling the company and still seeing kind of us hitting the milestones we wanted to hit and the business still growing at a healthy rate, you know, even though it was very challenging, and especially first half of the year, you know, I had never obviously, you know, been in a management position in a company that was scaling at this level. So I had a lot of new things to learn. And, you know, leaning on teammates at some stages of it, probably working too many hours, but, you know, you kind of from time to time have to in this world, just the reality of it. And
so thinking about all of those things you've learned, you know, you go through that scaling experience, you were looking forward to it. You knew you were going to scale. You had a plan, but some stuff surprised you. What would be the advice that you would give to end of 2017 Steve to help prepare yourself?
Yeah, I think it's just don't underestimate how much time it takes to hire 10 people. It seems like not a huge number. You know, it's like, oh, 10 people, you know, can do 10 interviews. But whenever you put out, if you get a fundraise and you put out a big announcement, you're going to attract a lot of attention. And when you raise that kind of capital and you are trying to continue to build a very healthy and strong business that, you know, has, that will maintain the culture that it has had for 3 years, and not only maintain, but expand and grow and make that culture even better. You want to keep going up and to the right. The amount of time you will have to spend with candidates and in the process to ensure that that culture piece and that technical aptitude piece and that communication piece that you have worked so hard over the last however long to build, that you don't poison that. And so that was the mindset going into it, is like, look, we're having a great time here. We're building great tech. We're signing up great customers. Like, we're getting all this attention and press. And the reason is because we have amazing people in this company and we brought in lots of great people. And so if we're going to continue that, we have to continue to raise the bar on how we hire. And so that was the mindset going in, but I don't think I knew just how much time that would require. And I think the other piece was we also stacked up our roadmap and all of our initiatives in Q1. We didn't like compensate for the fact that we would have to spend so much time on recruiting. So what happened was we sort of set expectations about what we'd deliver in Q1, and we were unable to hit those expectations, which causes ripple effects throughout the whole business. And if we would have had a better solution there to help manage that whole process, bringing in engineering talent and helping us, you know, spot the good ones at a glance before we go waste hours of time on, you know, multiple dead ends, we may have been able to hit some of those initiatives, and who knows, the numbers may have ended up being higher at the end of the year.
So plan for the influx, taking a lot of your time, try to get a system in place. It sounds like you kind of got something going there, and then maybe. And I guess it's related to one. If you're planning for the time, you got to change your roadmap expectations, it sounds like.
Yes.
Do you have a sense for how long it takes you to hire an engineer, like your organization?
I think we've hired, you know, from the post date to hire as quickly as 2 to 3 weeks. That was like, you know, lightning strike. Probably will never happen again that way.
That's pretty fast.
To as long as 6 months. And, you know, the 6 month one was for a more senior caliber engineer that, you know, we had some major performance initiatives and re-architecture initiatives that we needed to bring in someone who really knew their stuff and didn't need a lot of hand holding. And, you know, that's a really hard thing to find, right? So you want to wait for the right one in that case, but still 6 months is probably on the extreme end of that. And that impact, I mean, talk about roadmap and ripple effects. You know, you think it's going to take maybe tops 2 to 3 months to hire somebody, and then you try to plan for the next quarter and you still don't have that person, and you're relying on that person to hit the next quarter's objective. That's something that I've observed in the last year.
And about how many, if you had to put a number on how many hours it would take you to make let's say one of the, not so much that 6 months really high-end hire, but kind of your bread and butter software engineer hire, how much time does it take you as the hiring manager?
You mean in terms of the process?
Kind of like hours. Like if you had to be like, you know, I can, it's going to take me 30 hours of my time. So I'm going to get to, I can, you know, I can only do 5 of these in a month.
Right. Yeah. I mean, back in those days, it was writing the job description, posting it, you know, managing all the candidates, phone screen, couple interviews, putting the offer letter together, the whole thing. I mean, it was definitely a multi-hour experience, probably dozens of hours per candidate, and that just the context switching and how you have to start thinking about recruiting and then jump over to like architecture for a new microservice. This, you know, that impacts everything else.
So outside of raising $20 million and like airdropping in the cavalry to help, what are some things you can do to kind of you would recommend folks to kind of reduce the amount of time and effort it takes to make those hiring?
So I would say, first of all, find something that can help you with screening candidates very early in the process, save a lot of time on those phone screens. That would have been really helpful for me. I think would have had a big impact on us early on. Don't underestimate the importance of technical aptitude and communication aptitude early in the process. I think you have to figure out how to say no and how to push back and not just assume that what someone is saying, because they're throwing out names of frameworks and, you know, they've built a thing using React before, and they've been a dev for 5 years. Well, maybe they just built a Hello World app in React and they've been doing PHP for 5 years, right? So that sort of thing has to be plucked out early on. And so in the interview, you know, don't be afraid to push back. You know, I think a lot of engineers, you know, that I've seen, at least in my experience, in those types of environments, aren't willing to really push back and ask for more detail because they're, you know, maybe uncomfortable with that, like confrontation. If you're going to be a hiring manager bringing in a lot of people, you have to get comfortable with some level of confrontation. You can do it in a way that's nice and that, you know, doesn't rub them the wrong way, but gotta take almost a sales mindset to that process where, you know, you're really digging in and trying to get to the heart of the experience that is relevant to the projects and initiatives you need that position filled for.
Yeah. I like, it's like follow-up questions are the thing that I think make a great interviewer. Not so much the original questions, like those are important, but the best interviews I've been in have been someone that's really good at digging in. So you know, asking about that React app that you build, so you can find out that it's actually just Hello World.
Right.
Versus like, yeah, my gut says this person is really good at React.
Right.
They said Flux. Yeah. Flux is cool. I remember.
Yeah,
Flux.
Exactly. It could be, hey, is that on GitHub? Why don't you pull it up here? We'll throw it up on the screen. You can walk us through the code. Like, you know, I mean, if someone is really, really passionate and interested in coming to work here, which is another really important factor for us, we always ask in our interviews, why Springbuck? And we have to be sold on that person's desire to be here, right? We believe that we've got, you know, top-notch culture and we've got great folks and we're working on a big mission to prevent disease with data. And we want people that come in to feel the same way and to want to continue to level that up. And so that's a question that, you know, is really important part of the interview.
So magic wand, Steve, you've got this magic wand. You can spread one idea out into the zeitgeist about hiring that'll improve hiring, that'll improve the state of developer hiring. What's the idea that you spread with your magic wand?
So I think it's some kind of, and this exists, like AngelList is sort of trying to do this, but it doesn't really have any verified, trusted reviews that back the engineers. And so one thought that I had was, I mean, obviously what you guys are doing with the Woven score and the assessments is a lot of great data. And so how can I, as someone who's looking to recruit top talent in Indianapolis and nationwide, go somewhere like an Angie's List style place that has trusted reviews, and I'm sure there's tons of holes to shoot in that. But you know, give me the top-notch candidates. They've been vetted technically. They've been vetted for their communication skills, and you know, they're connected to other people that are really solid. And then you kind of build out a network and go from there. So I'm sure there's tons of flaws, but I would just love to have that magic portal that I can see all the devs and if they're a fit or not.
Yeah, so it's magic, so it doesn't have to exist. So you'd like to be able to see the data for all the engineers and then kind of make those decisions with data. Yeah, I would like that magic thing too.
Yeah, it'd be nice.
Who's the best engineer you've worked with that is bad on paper? So their resume was unconventional, they had a weird background.
That is a great question. You know, we've had a couple of folk who didn't have like any Ruby experience, who we've interviewed here, that I looked at their resume, and luckily we had Woven at this point because I would have passed on the resume, but because we had done the assessments, like having that person stack up against our team, we're like, that's really interesting. Like they scored really, really well on this. Let's bring them in. And so we hired them, and basically they're already crushing it, contributing to major API initiatives and just fitting into the culture. And that was really the light bulb moment for me, like with you guys. Like it's having that diamond in the rough experience. That one's top of mind for me right now.
Someone came in, they didn't have a resume with the right tech stack, but you thought you'd take a chance and you found someone that's a really strong engineer for your team.
Exactly.
That's awesome to hear. Those are the things that make me really happy.
They should. That means you're onto something.
Yeah. I think there's lots of people out there getting rejected for jobs that they could do well at. So anything we can do as an industry to stop that pain from happening.
Right.
What's a belief about leading software teams that maybe younger Steve would have disagreed with that you currently believe?
That I don't have to do everything. And what I mean by that is, you know, in the early days, when I was just all day long banging keyboard, cranking out stuff, you know, I wanted to start taking on sort of more managerial types of tasks, but I wasn't able to let go of the reins of being in the weeds in the code and wanting to influence, not strategically, but influence tactically, like how the product was being developed or whatever project we were working on was being developed. And what I've learned now is great leaders actually delegate what needs to be done. And again, it sounds like such a common sense thing, but it's really hard to do in practice whenever you want to have control of...
When you care.
Yeah, when you care, exactly. And I just, you know, I've always kind of trusted those around me to pull their weight and to get things done. And so as I've grown in my career and had the opportunity to hire a fair amount of people at this point, you know, folks that report directly to me, they will tell you that I'm extremely hands-off and I'm more hands-off than most. But that is, I believe, that's been like the number one key to the success that my teams have had over the last couple of years, at least in terms of my impact on those teams' success. I think it's easy to get stuck in the mindset of, well, you know, you're not actually building that product. So how, as the leader, can you like take some credit for that success of that product? Because you didn't write the code, like you were, you know. But at the end of the day, bringing people in, creating an environment where they can communicate efficiently, getting them the tools they need, and getting out of the way is the best way to build successful tech products and probably successful businesses in general. There's a lot of other factors that go in, but I think when it comes to teams, that's been my approach. So,
and younger Steve was more on the keyboard?
Yeah, younger Steve wanted to be the guy that built the whole software package. You know, I did that a few times and it's fun, and it was a way to learn a lot of stuff and to be able to get in front of people and present it and basically say, hey, this is this thing that I built, you know, from my brain, and I'm going to put it out there, and this is going to be...
Feels good.
Yeah, it feels great. But it feels a lot better to have like 40 people putting their brain power into, you know, 5 different product lines and aligning all of those folks with external, internal stakeholders, and then seeing all of that go to market and not taking credit for it, but just knowing that you sort of quietly did some things that created some like magic in a group of people. That's a whole lot better. That feels really good.
Charity Majors has this post. She's a CEO at a company called Honeycomb. She writes about the manager pendulum or ladder. She talks a lot about how when we become managers, we have to rewire our brain's reward system. Like, we're used to that dopamine hit of like, you fix a problem, you troubleshoot, you make a commit, and we have to rewire it to more long-term. Like you said, this thing gets delivered. You created the conditions of success, which is never, you know, it doesn't get you that constant drip of like, yeah, that test was red and now it's green. I think it's hard. It's just,
yeah. Well, I've found a way to still have that drip through just side projects. And that's another part of sort of that taking care of myself, is part of the time that I set aside for myself is to just be creative and work on other things. So I'm working on a JavaScript game right now. You know, I've built a Slack bot in the last couple of months. The Slack bot is actually internal. So I think by still staying in the code and still being putting out small tools that are useful for the company, you know, I'm adding value to the company. I'm scratching the itch of creating something, and I'm not totally rusty on how to interact with the Slack bot interface in 2019. So that's, you know, that's a very small percentage of my time, but I do think that it's something that everyone should incorporate.
And if your Slack bot features are a couple of weeks late, it's not going to hurt your customers.
Yeah.
Not critical path.
Not touching production code, not responsible for features in the app. Have tried that. Bad idea. Done with that.
This show is brought to you by my startup, Woven. At Woven, we help software teams hit ambitious hiring goals. We do that by improving the fuzziest step in the hiring process, candidate screening. By giving every candidate a fair chance to show what they can do, our customers find more great candidates and they back their decisions with evidence to remove bias. If you want to learn more about how Woven could help you scale your development team, check us out at woventeams.com. What advice do you have for an engineer looking to get hired on your team?
Have a strong GitHub presence, communicate well, and show us that you're bought in to the vision of what we're doing and not, you know, just looking for a paycheck.
If I were interviewing for a job at Springbuck, what could I do to stand out beyond having GitHub profile, saying that, you know, communicating why I wanted to work there? What else could I do to stand out?
I think ask a lot of questions that you dig in deeper, follow up, just like we talked about earlier. You know, it goes both ways. So if you're interviewing and you start digging in deeper to, oh, you said you're using Elasticsearch, tell me more about your implementation of Elasticsearch. Don't just say, oh yeah, I'm good with Elasticsearch. Like, ask questions, do a little bit of research before the interview and find out what we're using, and then dig into how we're using it.
What's a mistake you've seen an engineering candidate make in an interview that they didn't know they were making?
Coming across as too intelligent, too smart, too arrogant for everybody else in the room. I think that, you know, I think one instance really stands out to me where the engineer just in their mind thought they were, you know, the best thing since the internet. And you know, it really came across, and I don't think they realized that's sort of how they were acting. So that was a pretty big mistake. I think humility goes a long way. You know, I think you gotta be straightforward. You gotta ask a lot of good questions, but you also have to realize that you probably don't want to be the smartest person in the room.
Steve, thanks so much for being on Scaling Software Teams.
Thanks, Wes.
Thanks again to Steve for sharing his journey into engineering leadership. The challenges Steve has faced in the past year sound like champagne problems to some, but that doesn't make them less difficult. Growing fast is hard, and money doesn't make it much easier. If anything, raising a large round of funding can increase the pressure on our team and make our job as a manager even more difficult. What makes Steve's perspective so refreshing is the breadth of his background. going from the Army Corps of Engineers to launching and shuttering a smart device analytics startup to working for a high-growth scale-up. That's enough career for an entire lifetime, and Steve is just getting started. Here are a few of the key lessons we picked up from Steve. Have the confidence to execute on a consistent schedule. In a startup environment, it's easy to put on our superhero cape, work a long day, and pat ourselves on the back for a job well done. Not only is this strategy not sustainable long-term, it can lead to lower short-term quality. Our code is worse at hour 12 compared to hour 2. Steve suffered burnout in previous roles, which forced him to reevaluate the way that he views goal setting. His solution is simple, as all great solutions are. Time box ourselves into regular working hours. The more exceptions we make for tight deadlines, the worse our output will be and the more rework will be required. That vicious cycle makes it harder for us to stay mentally and emotionally healthy. Hiring is time-consuming, aka expensive. When we ask, how much would it cost to hire another developer, we're often thinking about costs like salary, benefits, and maybe a headhunter fee. It's easy to ignore the opportunity cost of the time we spend doing screening and interviews. Steve said in this interview, "We didn't calculate how much time we would spend recruiting and hiring, which has ripple effects throughout the whole business." That's an easy mistake to make. When we're looking to rapidly expand our team, we need to scale down our roadmap goals accordingly. Sorting by aptitude cuts time and cost. The first hire that Steve ever made was perfect on paper. They were a 4.0 double major student straight out of school. They interviewed perfectly, and Steve was impressed. Unfortunately, they didn't have the technical aptitude to be successful. 6 weeks later, Steve was asking his boss to let him go. This was a foundational experience for Steve, and now he uses an evidence-based screening tool to prioritize applicants by their ability to actually do the work. It was great hearing Steve's story, and now I want to hear from you. Who are some talented engineering leaders you think I should be talking to? Email me at wes@woventeams.com or tweet me at @WesWinnem. I read every response, and I'd love to hear from you. I'm excited to learn along this journey with you, and I'm always looking for your feedback about how to make the show better. If you have anyone you think I should interview, tweet me at @WesWinnem or @Woven_Teams, and I'll reach out. Thank you so much for listening and subscribing, and I'll see you next Monday.